This episode is brought to you by Vanta. Vanta's trust management platform helps you quickly assess risk, streamline security reviews, and automate compliance for SOC 2, ISO 27001, and more. Learn how by watching Vanta's on-demand demo at vanta.com/WSJ.
From the Wall Street Journal, this is Instant Message. I'm David Pierce. This week is a slightly special episode. Instead of being all over the country, I'm here awkwardly close to Christopher Mims and Joanna Stern in a converted hotel room in Laguna, California. We just finished our annual DLive conference and we're all very tired.
Hi,
guys.
Yeah. And it's not awkward at all that we're all in one giant queen size bed.
We're all so close to each other.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Christopher, can you stand in the closet?
Excuse me.
We're actually in a hotel room right now. So, Christopher, if you could stand in the closet, it would make me feel better. Like, we're actually podcasting like normally.
Yeah. I'll stare at the wall.
That sounds good. So, there's a bunch of conference stuff that we're going to get to, and we'll get to that in a second. And the last segment of the podcast today is going to be a chunk of an interview from the conference with our editor-at-large, Jerry Baker, interviewing Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi. Joanna,
That's right.
He told you that's the correct pronunciation, right?
Khosrowshahi. I don't know. I got it right in my video.
That's all that matters. And Christopher and Joanna have our upgrade for the week, which is about Apple Watch bands that you're both wearing right now. But first, Christopher, I want you to explain smart dust, which you claim is a real thing and not nonsense.
Smart dust is totally a real thing. So you just imagine any kind of sensors or tiny computers that don't require batteries or their batteries recharge from the environment. So there's two varieties right now. There's this kind that it uses so little power that it actually harvests the power just from the ambient RF waves that are shooting through our body at every moment. So somebody actually did a demo where they did a cell phone with no batteries. It's just like reflections of the RF waves.
Just by picking up existing waves, it's able to power itself. Wow.
Yeah. And then the other new thing is that somebody got really good at thermoelectrics, which is creating electricity out of heat energy, which you harvest from the environment. So the idea is right now it's like the size of like an Alexa. Someday it'll be the size of a Coke can. Eventually it'll be the size of like a wristwatch. And you will just like airdrop these out of drones all over your farm or behind enemy lines or stick them to the wall in your house. And it is a perpetual computer because it is just gathering electricity from the environment and sensing things with a camera or a vibration sensor or it's a microphone and just wirelessly sending that data back to some receiving station. So that is smart dust. But right now it's like smart Coke cans, but eventually it'll get smaller.
But how is it powered? Like wireless power has been such a challenge for the tech industry for like ever.
Yeah. Well, the real challenge with wireless power is getting enough power.
Yeah.
So part of the real innovation here is these very special kinds of circuits that require like minuscule amounts of power. So like, you know, the lowest power processor CPU in your phone is going to be like 1 to 5 watts. And these processors use milli or even microwatts to compute.
So it's the difference between like powering your car and powering like a light bulb.
Exactly. It's like a little, imagine those hand crank flashlights versus a Tesla in ludicrous mode.
So what would be the biggest like practical asset for us if this starts to work? Like what would be like a real benefit to us?
Well, spies love this.
Oh,
there's a lot of funding for that kind of thing. Just drop a bunch of microphones behind enemy lines and never change the batteries again.
That they literally can't even see because they're so small.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there's definitely funding for that. And I think other benefits could be, well, one example I thought was really interesting was, you know, 50 pounds out of every car is just wires connecting all these sensors to the computers. So one way you could use it is you could actually use it in a place where you maybe could change the batteries. It'd just be a pain. And you just have a bunch of sensors that are wirelessly sending back data. And it just, you know, same reason that we all like wireless mice. Like we already have sensors in our environment. Let's just cut the cord.
So the thing about this to me is it feels like on one level sort of obvious. It's like we've been on this march forever where everything is getting simultaneously faster and smaller and more efficient. And so it's like, well, of course that's possible, right? Like, and it's Moore's law, but with 10 million other things where it's like, eventually everything will be tiny and all we'll need is tiny phones. I don't know.
Totally.
But like, it seems like at some point we're going to hit a wall of development where that stops being possible. Like, is this smart dust thing real and sort of on the same trajectory that we've been on all this time? Or is there some giant thing in between here and there?
It's definitely real, but it is also just weirder. I mean, we're not talking about making your phone, use no power and be vanishingly small. Just the laws of physics mean that there's only certain things you can do with really low-powered circuits. So they're great for sensors. They're great for just very minimal amounts of compute. And they may never be more than that. But it would be cool if we could just scatter them all over the environment.
Yeah. Which does feel like the only way this stuff is going to work in the long run is that, like, everybody talks about the smart home, and right now it's the equivalent of putting four smart things into your home and calling it a smart home.
Right.
And when I talk to people, all they say is, like, what we need is orders of magnitude more data than we actually have. And, like, ignoring the fact that you should be deeply uncomfortable at the idea of millions of invincible sensors being all over your house.
Invincible sensors.
Invincible and invisible sensors.
They're invincible. Yeah, you, they can beat us.
What happens if they get hacked, right? Then you have, like, a forever botnet.
Right. And, but it is sort of like the world is going to be sensors, right? And it's going to need to be if it's going to be as smart as we think it's going to be, because the data collection needs are just about to go through the roof.
Yeah, yeah. So, I mean, there's definitely some sinister implications of that. I mean, it'd be great if you're a farmer and you just want to know what the moisture content of your soil is or whatever. Right. But it'll also be terrible if you're just like, oh, God, is this? Are there microphones in this room? Oh, of course there are. There's microphones in every room.
Are cameras part of this?
Cameras are definitely part of it. Cameras are a little harder. But the sort of interesting engineering problem is, like, if you can do enough compute locally, you just send a little bit of data back to the cloud. So maybe you have a camera that's really just sensing motion or... Because right now, I mean, recognizing faces is a really... It takes a lot of computing power. Yeah. We're not going to have smart dust that's recognizing our human faces anytime soon.
I mean, I don't know if that's... It seems like 5 minutes ago, nothing could recognize our faces. So, I mean, what's your sense of how much the people who are working on this are actually thinking about all those sinister implications? Like, it's one thing that it's cool for spies, and it sounds awesome for spies. Mm-hmm. Like, there's a James Bond movie about this just waiting to happen, where he's, like, in a helicopter just, like, spraying
And
dust.
Who is working on this?
Yeah.
Yeah, so there's a company called Matrix, and they actually make a thing you can buy now.
It's literally a company called Matrix.
Yeah.
It's a little on the nose.
It is. So the Matrix Power Watch is a fitness tracker that is just powered from your body heat. So that's the thermoelectrics people. And then in terms of the wireless stuff, I mean, every time you use like an NFC thing, your credit card, you already have this in your wallet.
Right.
Or if you have one of those European style contactless, or that they're going to use on the subway system in New York City. So that's an example of the technology.
Okay. It's continually amazing to me how much the future of everything is just about power. It's like the only thing in the way of so many things is figuring out how to literally just be able to turn it on.
Charging. Yeah. Charging is the future. Charging.
Yeah.
Charging bricks, charging cords. I mean, this is the future.
Yeah.
And unless we get smart dust, which has like been the biggest holdup that they've talked about with the wireless power industry or wireless. I mean, going back 15 years, there was a company out of MIT, and the biggest challenge was sending large amounts of power over the air. And so what you're talking about is small amounts of power. So, like, this seems like a solution that for a problem that they've just been trying to fight for a number of years now.
Yeah, but it's almost like an admission of failure at some point where they're like, well, we can't figure out how to power hard things.
Yeah.
So let's just make easy things and make a lot of them.
Well, it's just, I mean, it's physics. Like, if you want to send a lot of power over the air and you step in front of that beam, you're going to get cooked.
Right.
It's microwaves.
We've all, I feel like, sort of loosely been reporting on when real wireless power is going to happen. Forever. Like, I've been asking this question for people as long as
every
I've been
year
doing
I go
this.
To see.
Yeah,
yes.
You guys holding out on
every
us?
Single
Apple
year.
Sent you a smart mat yet?
No, nope. No, air power can't
air
even
power,
can't even get air power. Every year, a couple of companies I could name them, but it's not nice. They say the same thing every year.
It's a bunch of cool science projects that are
they got logos, nonsense. They got names,
they got logos. That's good.
But I'm not sure they ever have technology.
I've been thinking about all of the stuff that happened at the conference this week. And I feel like the biggest trend of it all was there was this weird debate over what responsibility tech companies have to users and to society. There was Kevin Systrom, who the creator of Instagram, saying Facebook has to do more, that it's so big that I think he said the rules of physics don't apply anymore. There were venture capitalists wrestling with what they're supposed to do with the money they're getting from Saudi Arabia. And with the HQ2 stuff, the Amazon news that we talked about on this podcast last week, that they're opening two new headquarters in New York City and Northern Virginia, there's this big debate over whether Amazon should have done what's best for Amazon, which it clearly just did, or actually try and you know, do right by the world or help somebody or go out of its way. And I don't know. I didn't get the sense anybody has answers to any of this, but it was sort of encouraging. It felt like people are actually asking some of these questions for like the first time. I don't know. What did you guys make of all of this? You were talking to a lot of these people.
I don't know. It sounds like you just got snowed by the free food.
Probably.
Yeah.
There's a lot of coffee.
You're like sunshine.
The wine was good. Yeah. There's a pool outside.
Now you've literally drunk the Kool-Aid. Now you understand why everyone in Silicon Valley is so high on themselves all the time.
Yet I'm literally falling asleep on the microphone. This week was exhausting.
It's what New York does to you.
Yeah. I mean, I was pretty much already like your town hall, which was great, and was talking to everyone from congressmen and women to Palmer Luckey, the former Facebook executive and founder of Oculus about
and
democracy.
And current head of Anduril, which is a defense company.
I mean, I thought that was one of the more fascinating conversations because it was all these people you wouldn't expect to agree, Steve Ballmer as well, all these people you wouldn't expect to agree on how companies should be regulated and how privacy should be sort of looked at as both a business and a marker of democracy, agreeing that more needs to be done. I actually thought it was like you were gonna have to like separate. It was like you're gonna have to hold people back, but everyone was really actually like, no, we need this.
Yeah, it was shocking the level of agreement, and it just cuts across all ideological bounds. And it's funny to think that, you know, if Tim Cook and Mark Zuckerberg and Sundar Pichai were the three oligarchs of America, they would have already regulated themselves. Like, they're literally just waiting for Congress. They're like, please give us. And part of it is, in their self-interest, California just passed that privacy bill. Mm-hmm. And their nightmare is California, Vermont, right. North Dakota all have different regulations. They just want federal regulation to supersede all that. But they also, I think, earnestly know that somebody needs to set some ground rules that they can all obey, mm-hmm. so that it's not a race to the bottom on certain things.
Yeah. I also thought it was really interesting to hear elected officials basically just crap on other elected officials for not knowing what the hell they're talking about.
Yeah, that was one of the best.
Oh, when Silicon Valley went after Congress, and
he's right. I mean, the
questions
they
were
asking.
Well, that's because his district is Silicon Valley. So that's his thing.
Right, as it should be. But like,
we should roll that here if we can.
Sounds like you just teed it up.
What do each of you think the year 2019 has in store in terms of government regulation in or on social media platforms? Ro, maybe you can kick off that.
I think, imagine if Microsoft, Apple, Google, Intel, Yahoo weren't American companies. Imagine if they were German companies or Chinese companies. The reason we're going to win the 21st century, in my view, is partly because of tech. So we need to regulate it. But I'll tell you, when I go around the country to Paintsville, Kentucky, or Youngstown, Ohio, you know what they ask me? How do we get those jobs? How do we participate in that? So we've got to regulate it thoughtfully, but we want to make sure we're remaining the innovation leader.
The one thing I think you can count on is that you're going to get more, what little regulation will occur will be more thoughtful simply because you have highly divided government after this last election. And it tends to mean that the new guys in town in the House are going to be demanding all kinds of things, and they're going to walk into, okay, you'd better demand something we were already interested in, or you're not going to get it. And that's actually pretty healthy for the tech industry, because they know, they can with confidence know, that only their egregious mistakes are going to be under scrutiny, and not a potpourri of we'd like it to be different. And lastly, you said it very well, if regulation is so good, let's look to the Europeans who have been over-interested in regulating American companies and see how much of that has actually been worthwhile.
I want to add, if you don't mind, Jerry.
Yeah, go
for it. I would hate to see the regulation in the hands of the Congress. I think it would be absolutely the worst thing to happen. Regulation in the hands of the FTC, yeah, I get that. Or the DOJ, I get that. The difference is those are people who can put staffs on to really understand the detail. I basically kind of agree with you on data breach, but I also don't agree with you. Do you really want to tell somebody right away their data's been breached before you figure out how to solve the next data breach, that data breach problem? Therefore, identifying to everybody out there, including guys who want to suck the data, you have to be really careful on that regulation, or you will wind up actually self-perpetuating more data breach. That's why I think it's super important to have experts, the best experts we're going to get are going to be either at the FTC or the DOJ. And as much as that can be painful for a company, at least you're sitting down with other technical experts who represent the interests of the people, who are non-political. And I think that's important.
It is possible that all of this is just like the things that people say to each other when they get into a room, and none of it actually means anything, that it's just easier to like hold hands when you're on the beaches of Laguna and then go away. But it's just funny to see, there was the, I forget who had it, but there was some story about how all these people are leaving Instagram and then deleting Instagram, like out of recognition that this thing isn't good.
Is quitting Instagram the new quitting Facebook?
I hadn't heard this. Yeah, people who are super early at Instagram are like not only leaving the company, but getting rid of the app. And they're like, we don't know what we've done.
Hmm. Oh, the people that work at Instagram are leaving it. Oh, okay. I thought you meant like users.
Oh, well, influencers. I think that does not seem to be happening.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of people in money on Instagram.
Yeah, because Sistrom was saying that he can't even believe that it's still as big as it's getting.
Yeah. And I loved Matt Murray, our editor chief, asked him about IGTV. Mm-hmm. And his answer was something to the effect of, I'm really sad I didn't get to work on it more, which is like my favorite code for it's trash. I wish we'd fixed it. But I don't know. I mean, do you guys come out of this with any sense of sort of where we are at things? Like, it feels like this was a lot of people who are in charge of things sitting in a room debating what to do about any of it.
To me, it feels like we're at a low ebb. Like, tech has been sort of beaten down, right? Like, it was this incredibly confident, even arrogant industry. I mean, even the fact that we have Dara instead of Travis representing Uber, right? I mean, what's your sense, Joanna?
Yeah, and actually, I think that's a funny contrast, because I spent a lot of time with Steve Ballmer here. I interviewed him as the kickoff session, and then I did an interview with him in our elevator series. And the first question I asked him when we kicked off the onstage session was like, are you happy you're out of this? Like, are you happy that like you're not, like, do you think the fun and games of the tech industry is all over? And I thought his answer was good. We can roll it here.
I dealt with my antitrust issue. Let the rest of them deal with theirs. Antitrust, privacy. We dealt with all of them. They just come in cycles.
I thought his answer was really interesting. And it kind of was a nice reminder that, like, yes, there was a whole period of tech before this that also went through that period of regulation, and are these companies getting too big, and the competition of the companies. And yeah, like, this looks a little bit different, but like, it's a cycle. And I thought his perspective also on regulation, I mean, of course, it's easy for him to say now. He's like, you need to deal with the regulators. You need to, embrace the change. You need to take a hard look at your
business model. Which 20 years ago, he felt very differently about it.
Totally. And I was like, that's what I called him out for. I was like, I just watched you on like C-SPAN from 2011 on YouTube, and like, you did not seem happy. You did not. I mean, he still looked the same, frankly. Yeah. But it's good for him.
Yeah.
But I just thought that was an interesting point. I actually felt like, there was a time where Steve Ballmer wasn't like the most credible in the room about some of things. And he really felt like he brought like this new perspective to this new challenge in tech.
Yeah. It does feel different now in some way, though. I don't know. Like, the thing that struck me so much listening to your panel was realizing how much tech touches now. Like, listening to these people talk about these huge government things that they're getting, and Palmer Luckey in the middle of saying some really awful things, made the point that the best people are in tech. And like, if there is an imperative to help your country, the best people who make the most money to do this work are working in tech. They're not getting jobs at the Air Force anymore.
Yeah, engineers aren't working on the Manhattan Project anymore. They're optimizing advertising algorithms.
Right. And so it's like, if that's where all the power and all the money is, like, what is the right way of putting that back into the world? I don't know. It's a weird question.
I just feel like that's why HQ2 Amazon's is going to be in Virginia, because eventually Bezos is going to be Secretary of State or whatever, and then it'll just be the United States of Amazon or something like that. No, I seriously, it sounds like paranoid, but I do genuinely think that right now we're in this phase where the government is coming in and it's cyclical and regulating tech, but the two are both going to be transformed by this interaction. Like, government is going to, I think the way that we govern ourselves is going to change as a result of, it has to, because it's always changed by technology.
But it was at least interesting to hear how many people are thinking about this. And like, the scale of internet problems have just gotten so big. I feel like it's easy to forget in the day to day, but to have everybody sit there and be like, no, all this stuff is actually the whole world now.
Right. I think also there was wild. Like, maybe 2 to 3 years ago at this conference, there was like this theme of like, companies being like, well, what is a tech company, right? And this like blurring of the lines between tech company and regular company. You know, every company was like, no, we're not. Every company has to be a tech company. And like you felt that here too with some of the non quote unquote tech companies. And that sort of tells you like the blurring of the lines. Like you spoke to Allbirds CEO today and like he doesn't think that they're a tech company, but like they're making a lot of money through online advertisements.
And, right. And they're raising money like a tech company. And yeah,
exactly. Or you had the CEO of Hint Water and she was talking about the same sort of thing. You had Bumble, who is a dating app, but is like becoming another social network for women. Like all these companies are basically like, we're not tech companies, but like, because intrinsically every company now is a tech company.
Right. And if you're not, you're Sears, right? So Walmart is a tech company and Sears is not. And that's the result.
Yep.
Yeah. Or Gwyneth Paltrow, she started talking about all the developers she's hiring for Goop. I believe it completely. She's like, I don't think email is going to be a good channel for me going forward. And I was like, you know, this isn't the Gwyneth Paltrow of my youth. And, you know, God bless her. It's great that she's just like moving forward and I'm going to go build this media empire. And the first thing I need to do is create a moat where I have my own, you know, distribution technology.
Yeah. Can I make a sliding doors joke in here now or...
You've been waiting now almost 24 hours to do this.
24 hours to make a sliding doors joke. Go ahead. I really wanted to get her in the elevator series so I could make a sliding doors joke. And all my hopes are dead.
That's really upsetting. Coming up in a sec, we're going to get to Jerry Baker's interview with Uber CEO, Joanna, say his name.
Dara Khosrowshahi.
Okay. Dara, we're sorry. But before we get to that, Joanna and Christopher, you're both wearing Apple Watches. They both have bands, and neither of them is made by Apple, and you have both separately told me how proud you are of that fact. Joanna, you first explain.
Let's back up here.
Okay.
Apple sells the Milanese Loop.
Which is the like, cool metal one that folds over on itself.
The Milanese Loop. It's like the Italian dinner Milanese chicken.
Yes.
But in a loop. So they sell it for $150. I'm going to put this in my calculator. And I paid $11 for this one. I should have just asked you guys.
And it's convincing.
Can you tell the difference?
It looks like, no.
Can you tell the difference?
Well, we were like at the Apple event in New York a few weeks ago, and there was somebody standing there with the actual Milanese Loop on, and we couldn't find any
difference. We couldn't find any difference.
Wow.
Even and I hadn't even known this existed, but on the end of the band or on the clasp that closes the band, there's a little divot for a fingernail so you can lift up the loop more easily.
Yeah.
I have it on mine. $11. $11 on Amazon. And I'm going to look up the brand right now in my buying history.
So this, I think what's really remarkable then, so people always talk about the Apple premium and their margins. This is the, in all of history, this is the highest markup of any Apple item then.
The Milanese Loop.
Because normally people are like, oh, they got like a 30, 40% margin on the phone. So this is like a 15x difference.
I mean, my guess is that like Apple is using a much nicer metal and like it's as Johnny Ive would like wax poetic about the aluminium and like... Can someone say it in their accent?
Nope, that
better?
Was perfect.
And like, it probably is like totally better. But here's the thing. My wrist has, or my skin has not turned green. My hand has not fell off. This band works perfectly fine. And everyone is convinced that it's beautiful.
Can I just say one thing about Apple's accessories, including like the original iPad smart cover? Those are not manufactured by Apple. Those are contracted. But the people that they contract to who manufacture them in China are just under a bazillion NDAs and cannot talk about it. So it is entirely possible that there is almost no or zero quality difference between your $11 thing and Apple's $150 thing. It could really be that level of markup.
Okay, Mims, I'm just going to say right now, I'm sure our editor is listening to this, I want to do a story on this.
You got to.
I need to do this story. I hope Apple does not listen to our podcasts. I want to do
this
story.
Thank you, former Apple reporter for the Wall Street Journal, who shall remain nameless.
We should not talk about him.
Wait, Mims, before we move on, what is your band?
So my band has a very long name, and Apple does not make it because it is it's like the cargo shorts of Apple Watch bands. It's the Aimtel Hybrid Rubber Leather Sports Bands.
Oh boy.
Compatible with sweat-proof silicone vintage Apple Watch band, iWatch Series 4. It goes on.
You got to love product names on Amazon.
Yeah, it's like the new SEO.
It's just so SEO.
90s like era
SEO. Every product that's ever been sold in this category into the title.
Yeah. And so I'm sure it is it's Amazon's choice for some string of words that I would never search for. And it is $16. And it's what makes it nice is that it looks like it's what is it? Business in the front, party in the back. It looks like it's leather on the outside, so I can wear it with this suit jacket that I'm wearing. But on the inside, it's just silicone rubber, so I can run with it. And the reason that I like it is that I never have to change my watch band ever again, which I feel like is the most dad recommendation for something ever.
You are such a dad. But the crazy, how many are you looking at your listing? Mine has almost 800 reviews.
Mine is 16. Mine so it's a miracle this thing reviews. Hasn't fallen apart yet.
Yeah, mine has 800 reviews and it's 4 stars. That's not crazy.
Bad. That's not bad. $11. Buy like 10 of them.
Aura Bay.
Sell the rest.
Aura Bay is doing so well.
Aura Bay.
Can we buy stock in Aura Bay?
Yeah.
Okay. We're standards alert. We cannot buy stock in any company.
We're saving everybody money though, so that's good.
Yeah.
We just saved you what, like $225.
But if you guys can buy stock, I would buy stock in Aura Bay.
Okay. So coming up in just a second, Wall Street Journal editor-at-large Gerard Baker and Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi.
That's nice.
Nailed it.
This message comes from Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Up next, it's time to check in on Uber's corporate culture transformation, its ride-sharing business, Uber Freight and Uber Eats, and there's that IPO that is apparently happening next year. So welcome to the stage, Wall Street Journal editor-at-large Gerard Baker and Uber CEO Dara Khosrowshahi.
Thank you, David. Thank you all. Thank you all for staying through to the end of the day. Dara, welcome. Thank you very much.
Thank you for having me.
Busy time for you. Thank you for coming. Let me start, if I may, by asking you, the Wall Street Journal published a story last month saying that your long-awaited and much-anticipated IPO, everybody's talking about for next year, is being touted, possibly, at least by your investment banks, as valuing the company at $120 billion, up from the $70 billion, I think, just in the last round when SoftBank invested earlier this year. Raised a few eyebrows at story. I'm not expecting you to confirm or deny it, although do feel free to do so if you're so minded. But let me pose the question slightly differently. What is it do you think about, whatever the actual valuation might be eventually, what is it do you think about the company, and you've been chief executive for just over a year now, that a company like Uber that gives that company a potential valuation that is larger than the combined valuation of Ford, General Motors, and Fiat Chrysler?
So the number that was quoted was your number, not our number, just to be specific. I think the opportunity that we have as a company and our industry generally has is to really revolutionize mobility in general. And when you look at the mobility pie, this is a $6 trillion market. And what we're going after is essentially to debundle car ownership, just as the cable bundle has been debundled. We are going after all of the use cases of why someone would own a car. There are over a billion cars in the world. And we think a world in which the people who can not afford to buy a car have access to consistent mobility wherever they are. We think that's a better world. And as a market, it's a $6 trillion addressable market that we're going after in terms of moving people and things and freight. And I think we're in the driver's seat, to use your term.
Let me turn to the culture of the company. You came in just over a year ago. You took over in, it's fair to say, fairly tumultuous circumstances. The founder, Travis Kalanick, had been ousted after what were widely deemed to be some transgressions, shall we say, and both presiding over and indeed perhaps even encouraging a culture that a lot of people found very unacceptable, all kinds of stories which we're all very familiar with. What have you done to address that? What do you think you've achieved so far, and how is the company different culturally from how it was 15 months ago?
Well, one of the first things that we did in, when I came in was look to refactor the values and the norms of the company as far as, and we call them norms, which is, it's expected behaviors, right? We didn't want it to be kind of words on a wall. And we actually went out and crowdsourced from our employee base, what kind of a company do you think is a great company? What kind of a company do you want to be proud to work for? And what came was very clear signal from the team in terms of what kind of company that they want to work at. And so we went out there and set forward a set of norms that would define behavior with an Uber. And it's norms like we celebrate differences and we act like owners and we value ideas over hierarchy and we do the right thing, period. Now that those norms are set and I have a management team that's a combination of new and old, now we have to move those behaviors into the everyday. And I think as a company externally, I think we've demonstrated that we've changed. And we are now much more inclusive in terms of working with cities and governments and being very open with our driver partners as far as how we build and how we innovate, something that I'm really excited about. In that, you know, it is not growth our way, but it's growth. It's not growth just our way, but it's growth, inclusive growth with partnership, which is how we are demonstrating what kind of a company we are externally. And internally, it's still a journey. You know, internally, I think, if anything, if I were to criticize myself in my first year, I'd say externally, we did a pretty good job as far as demonstrating actually how we are a different company. Internally, I think we have more to do. I think we've set the norms out. I think that we are starting to change as a company and become the kind of company that we're proud of. But we have more work to do to make sure that those behaviors not only define how I act, how my leadership team acts, but how four or five levels down in France, one of our operational managers is acting.
I mean, you're very different management style and a very different personality. No videos of you shouting at drivers, for example. You don't seem like that. But nonetheless, despite what you say about changing the public impression, there have been some continuing criticisms. There's the issue over Cameron Pitcher, I think it was, who was your head of business development, who was accused of inappropriate behavior with employees. I think he just recently did leave the company. Initially, he didn't. He moved. And then there's also been a question mark about arguably differential treatment between, is it Barney Harford, your COO, and Leanne Hansey, is it, who left? It was a woman who left the company after accusations again of inappropriate behavior. So there's some criticisms out there still that maybe you're not perhaps being quite as, you know, there's a lot of attention on Silicon Valley companies in this right now, but you're not being quite as vigilant about ensuring that you have a proper culture that respects all kinds of people there too. I mean, how do you respond to those criticisms?
I think the way that I respond is, one, I don't want to comment on the individual circumstances because they are personal. And by the way, they're very different. I can't control how individuals act within our company. But what I can control is how we respond. And I think we have responded in the right way, in a way that would make people proud. And I think every day as a company, we are getting better and better and more consistent. And it's a process. So are there going to be criticisms of how we act? Sure. But I think those criticisms come, the space between those criticisms is going to expand. And I'm very confident that as a company today, we're better than we were 6 months ago. And 6 months from now, we'll be much better.
Just on the autonomous question, we had chief executive of the head of Waymo this morning, a company you're very familiar with,
yes.
perhaps more familiar than they would like. But anyway, and he was saying that the most visionary realization of autonomous driving, so-called L5, was both sort of unrealistic and actually, in effect, unnecessary. I'm just wondering where you think, how far you think autonomous driving goes and how quickly we get there.
Yeah, listen, I agree in that I think that autonomous driving is very much a near to medium term possibility within a scope of operations and operational domain and or for certain skill sets that are required. So if you have to go into a gate, et cetera, don't use an autonomous car. So having a live network which is able to identify, is this particular ride within the operational domain and the skill sets that my driver has, and then able to route that request on a live basis, is the necessary and unique element that I think we bring. And that's why I'm saying we want to build this technology ourselves, but we absolutely want to partner with third parties to build it. Ultimately, it's about affordability and safety of transportation, which is something all of us should be for.
Quick one or two quick questions. Yes, there's a lady at the back there. Can you identify yourself, please?
Yeah, I'm Rachel Manson. I'm with Lightspeed Venture Partners. I'm obsessed with jump bikes. You were talking about them a little
Excellent.
Bit earlier. It is sincerely my favorite way to get from point A to point B in San Francisco. They're just the best. So I guess with that said, I'd love to better understand how you're thinking about your investment in bikes versus scooters in particular.
What we're seeing with bikes is that the average distance that bikes traverse is longer than the average distance of scooters. So bikes have more of an overlap with our current network than scooters. And honestly, we're pretty early here, right? Our hypothesis is that bikes tend to work better in hilly cities like San Francisco, and bikes tend to work better in cities that are a bit more spread out, let's say like a Dallas, than scooters. So scooters are really good in Santa Monica, flat, fairly compact. And so depending on the city, let's say Seattle, I think Seattle will be more of a bike company, bike city than a scooter city. One of the strengths that we bring is that we have the full network and we can essentially optimize our fleet for each city. And I think it's going to be different from city to city to city. The other detail here are regulators. And there are some regulators who kind of don't care. It's a vehicle one way or the other. Or there are some certain regulators who treat these vehicles differently. So all of it and every single city is different. So what you want to do is go in with a portfolio. We have a whole portfolio and have a complete kind of discourse with the city and build something that's good for consumers, good for the city, and good for us as well.
One more very quick question. If there's one last one, yes. There's a lady there just with the microphone coming to you. Yep.
Thank you. So what you just said, you're going to have to work with regulators.
Yes.
You have a fierce head-to-head competitor. But in this space, your interests are aligned. Can you see a point where you will have to work with them to work with the regulators to accomplish what needs to be done?
Yeah, listen, we're working with regulators today. It may surprise you.
No. My question was, will you have to work with your direct competitor will you have to work with Lyft?
You're talking about Lyft.
Accomplish what you need to accomplish.
I don't know who you were talking about, a direct competitor. They're a competitor, but I don't direct. So will we work with them? Yeah, sure. I actually do think that this is, you know, we and Lyft together account for less than 1% of miles driven in the cities in which we operate. People associate, we're a headline company, but we're a tiny, tiny, tiny part of the market. And ultimately, both of us are going after car ownership. We don't think people should own cars, and we don't think the only people who get around in a city should, or we don't think people who can afford cars should have the best transportation around. So I think from that standpoint, in working with regulators and trying to build out a framework that is friendly to the city, friendly to environments, and ultimately makes transportation available to everyone everywhere, not just folks in the city center, that's in both of our interests, and I think we would be happy to work with them to push that vision of a world forward.
My app says that Dara's driver is 1 minute away, so... Oh, no, he just canceled, so we got another... No, I'm kidding.
Thank you for that.
Not at all. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in thanking Dara very much.
Thank you very much.
And that's our show. Thanks to Joanna and Christopher for being here in this very cold hotel room. It's really nice to look at your faces, even though we're all pretty tired. And thank you for listening. We're going to have another episode this week with some of our favorite stuff from DLive, but usually new episodes come out on Fridays. So make sure you subscribe to Instant Message on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere you get your podcasts. If you have feedback or ideas, email us at personaltech@wsj.com. We'll talk to you next week.
This episode is brought to you by Charles Schwab. Decisions made in Washington can affect your portfolio every day, but what policy changes should investors be watching?
Washington Wise is an original podcast for investors from Charles Schwab that unpacks the stories making news in Washington and how they may affect your finances and portfolio. Listen at schwab.com/washingtonwise.